Members, we don't quite have a quorum just yet, but I think we're going to start on time and maybe people will get the message. I will remind everyone that cell phones create audio problems please turn them off. I will call us to order. Well, I can't call us to order, but I can invite the presenter, Commissioner McElroy, to the witness table to kind of talk about the budget priorities and their reasoning for them from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So if Commissioner McElroy would step to the table, and I will interrupt you as we get a quorum to call the meeting to order and pass the minutes and some of the housekeeping things. Commissioner McElroy, I want to thank you for coming today. Today we've got the indication from members has been that they have a tremendous amount of questions, a variety of them, and you are a wealth of information. But please, if we could keep our answers brief, because I'm going to ask the members to keep their questions pointed and not too all over the place. So, but I think, let me count here, it looks like we have a quorum. So I'm going to call the meeting to order. They tell me I have to make more noise. And I know Representative Oldman Miller has been looking at the minutes a whole lot and would like to move them. Thank you.
I move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative O'Mueller. Are there any changes or additions? All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Thank you for allowing me to interrupt you, Commissioner McElroy. If you'd identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. With me are a number of members of our management team that I will introduce and ask to come to the microphone if there are questions in their areas of expertise. We will do our best to keep our answers short. Our intention today is to talk about the policy framework, how did we make the decisions that led to our budget recommendations. Obviously, in a time when the needs are great in the recession, and when we made our budget recommendations, we knew that the needs were great, and in a time when there weren't a lot of easy decisions. And so the decisions we make don't reflect the fact that we're going to respect a wide variety of programs and partners, but that the low-hanging fruit in the budget world was harvested long ago, and so there were only tough choices left. We started our discussion, and I'm going to work briefly from this short handout that you have that has a few PowerPoint slides on it. We constantly keep in mind the mission statement of the agency, and it was written in 2003 when the agency was merged from the former Department of Economic Security and the former Department of Trade and Economic Development. And the mission is that we assist individuals, businesses, and communities achieve economic success through growth. In the accomplishment of that, we have six goals that we have identified and we work with very closely with our partners and that are reflected in our workforce strategic plan and our agency strategic plan. We're charged and work with a wide variety of partners at creating and retaining jobs, and we do that in the programs administered in our business and community development and business finance areas. We cultivate entrepreneurs, principally through our small business development centers, but also in partnership with great partners like Women Venture and MEDA and others. We're charged with enhancing community vitality, and we do that through programs like the Contaminated Sites Cleanup Program, the Redevelopment Fund, the Small Cities Economic Development Program, and with a wide variety of partners, including the McKnight Initiative Foundations and literally hundreds of others. We're charged with strengthening the workforce, and we do that through our partnership with workforce service areas, through the Job Skills Partnership Program, through partnerships with various youth-oriented employment programs, and a variety of others. We foster self-sufficiency. And we think of this most often in programs like State Services for the Blind, vocational rehabilitation, and the work we do with U.S. Social Security Administration in disability determination. But certainly we foster self-sufficiency in making unemployment insurance or administering unemployment insurance to provide income replacement for those who may have been laid off through no fault of their own, and in assisting job seekers in finding their next job. So fostering self-sufficiency is a key component in the work that we do. We also work hard in addressing economic change in a rapidly changing environment, participate in efforts like the Green Jobs Task Force, the Next Gen Energy Board, in work that we have done with the Humphrey Institute and a wide variety of partners in identifying emerging industry sectors and sectors that are very important in work referred to sometimes as dealing with the microeconomics of competitiveness. And we work with our workforce service partners and our economic development partners in trying to address economic change. We do that, and people have asked me, how many programs does DEED operate? And the answer is 55, and some of which have been around for a very long time, a handful of which, or perhaps one of which is relatively new, that came to us for a wide variety of reasons. Many of them are programs that have federal roots. Some of them are programs that have state roots but have been around a long time. If you look at the budget, our budget is moderately complicated, not in comparison to the Department of Human Service or some others, but for an agency of our size, it is relatively complicated. The money comes about 15% from the general fund, about 25% from the Workforce Development Fund and Special Revenue Fund, and the balance from a variety of federal sources. We have in the range of a dozen major federal contracts and partnerships with federal agencies in a wide variety of areas. The budget that you see is a reflection of directions from the Governor's Office and Minnesota Management and Budget that required us to reduce our appropriations both in the General Fund and the Workforce Development Fund while keeping in mind the importance of the mission and of the Governor's priorities of, around maintaining and creating jobs, improving our business climate, and taking advantage of emerging industry opportunities in things like clean technology, green energy, manufacturing for export, and food processing. Let me, in doing that, we had eight ideas that we kept in mind as we worked on the budget. One is that we were dealing, as I indicated, in an environment of a deficit. We knew when we worked on these ideas in October and November that we would have a significant deficit. We didn't know until the forecast that it was $4.8 billion. We knew that the governor's priorities were job creation, good-paying jobs, take advantage of the green opportunity, and that we had proposed in September a five-part green tech, clean tech initiative that we knew would be part of this budget. We thirdly maintained that the core missions, that all three were important, and we couldn't sacrifice one at the expense of the other, helping individuals, helping businesses, helping communities. Fourth, we kept in mind that we need to leverage, or that it's good policy to leverage, the maximum amount of federal funds. Our general fund proposal in 10-11 is about $77 million. That in some cases leverages $3.75 for every dollar of state funds in certain programs. The funds that have significant federal matches are vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, the small business development centers, the Centers for Independent Living, and the administrative portion of the HUD program for Small Cities Community Development Block Grant Program. And so one of the things that we kept in mind was the desire not to lose federal funds, either by failing to achieve the maintenance of effort level. And if you are not familiar with the federal maintenance of effort concept, it basically says if you spent $5 in the last biennium to match a federal program, you cannot spend less than $5 in the coming biennium. You can't ever go backwards. You have to maintain your effort in matching federal funds to achieve the various programs. So the need to leverage federal dollars and match federal funds was part of our consideration. We also took serious note of the staff impact. There are 1,600 talented, dedicated men and women who work at DEED. I didn't want to either scare them to death or diminish our capacity to deliver programs far into the future. So we tried to be considerate of their needs, and where we could, where we needed to reduce the headcount, to do it by holding open positions. We are the oldest agency in state government, and I don't say that because we have an ancient commissioner, but we have the most people closest to retirement, and we'll get some retirement opportunities over the next few years. But we tried to avoid a significant layoff in our budget planning where that was appropriate and where that was smart. We asked the question, as we looked at programs, both our internal programs and the pass-through grants to other agencies, can services be provided by others? Are there other options for those who need these services? Next, we asked the question, are there carry-forward funds available? A number of our programs are, we get appropriations that are available until spent. We will carry over dollars where that's appropriate. Are there dollars available from other places? Is it likely there may be stimulus dollars? We didn't know that at the time that this budget was proposed. We now know that there are some areas where there may be other budget opportunities. Some of our partners have significant private fundraising capacity. Others, there simply is no other place for people who need services to go, and we tried to be conscious of that as we made decisions. And finally, what will be the impact? And I don't mean I list it last, but it isn't by any means the least important. And we tried to ask in every situation, what's the impact of this decision on our ability to fulfill the mission, to do what we're here to do. With that, Mr. Chairman, if I could suggest that we go to perhaps the change summary, and I can go through the changes. If everyone has a budget book, it's on page 7 of the budget book, or do we not have... If people don't have budget books, I have a handout.
People need. Everyone's got the should have the budget book in their packet.
All right. Let me get make sure I'm in the right. I'm going to change and use the handout. Lynn, can you pass out that handout? I think that will be easier for people to follow, and it's got everything on one page. Mr. Chairman, I apologize, but we're trying to get you information that's as concise as possible, and things are a little scattered in the budget book.
And that's my just fine. Pages can pass that out.
All right. What I want to do is go through program by program what we're proposing to either add or subtract. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'll take your advice and stop talking and take questions. As soon as everybody has the handout. The handout is a summary of our budget from the general fund and the workforce development fund and the remediation fund as we propose it for 2010-11. The first column is the biennial base, which may be different than actual. There are some base adjustments. I think, if I may, I'll get into those in Representative Rukavina's committee and confine myself more to the policy questions in this committee, if that's fair.
And Commissioner McElroy, you're correct. This is a policy committee. It's a nice courtesy to go over the budget and to explain it in the context of how it affects your policy. So go right ahead.
All right. We organized the agency under the three areas of our mission, helping communities, businesses, and individuals. There is crossover. For example, unemployment insurance has an impact clearly on individual workers, but also on the ability of employers to keep their workforce in the area and not have them move away to take other jobs. Unemployment has an impact on communities in helping keep the workforce present and keep people viable. But essentially, you know, the mission divides to some extent that business and community development is involved in helping businesses and communities. That program is funded with $13,326,000 from the general fund in our base. We were asked to reduce that. Our proposal is to reduce that by $634,000. You can see that those reductions, that the reduction in kind of our core programs is $634,000. There are also some reductions in pass-through grants. The legislature has, over the years, appropriated money for a variety of nonprofit and governmental entities that come through various state agencies. Indeed, has had a lot of pass-through grants. And at our recommendation, the governor is proposing reducing some of those, but not all of them by any means, and some are left entirely untouched. The first program listed is the Small Business Innovative Research. Technically, we call it the Office of Science and Technology. We're proposing no cut to their base budget. They did have $400,000 in one-time funds, which I didn't have enough money, unfortunately, to get continued, but that money is available until spent. It's helping an SBIR. Some of you were able to attend the Science and Technology Day on the Hill last week. Small Business Innovative Research in the Office of Science and Technology is the work that a wonderful person, Betsy Lutz, does with some help, not enough help, to help entrepreneurs and inventors secure federal research grants to create companies and drive jobs in Minnesota. Women Venture, I think you're familiar with, and I won't go through their mission in detail. I can answer questions. We continue to value their partnership, but did have to recommend a reduction. Rural Policy and Development is an organization some of you are familiar with. It's a research-based organization now located in St. Peter with roots at Minnesota State Mankato. Great organization, not in the same kind of role of, it's a research organization, and I wish we'd had money for them. We did not. The Entrepreneur and Small Business Grants is the Riverbend Facilitation Center in Blue Earth. Our reason for not recommending funding is that we believe we can serve their customers through the Small Business Development Center in South Central Minnesota at Mankato, but we know that that's also a fine program, so we understand that they'll be advocating. MITA works principally with minority entrepreneurs and small businesses. They, in addition to the money they get from us, get money from the U.S. Department of Commerce for their Procurement Technical Assistance Center and have been very successful at raising funds. They also work with us in our Urban Initiatives microloan program, an organization we're very fond of, but we did have to take some reduction in their appropriation. The Minnesota Inventors Congress is both an event and a program to help inventors. It's been taking place in Redwood Falls for a very long time. It's been kind of in and out of the budget in years when we had funds available, not in some other years. And unfortunately, although they help entrepreneurs, we think that we hope we can provide those services through the Small Business Center. We understand that it has a great impact on their program. And we're recommending an appropriation for the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota, $100,000 each year, $200,000 for the biennium, to continue the work they've done in implementing the 2025 plan that was unveiled last week. The state has been a partner in that. I serve on the board of the Biobusiness Alliance. They would have liked to see just a larger amount. We simply didn't have the dollars to do a larger amount. Our second major division is the Workforce Development Division. Provides many of the partnership services that we provide with our Workforce Center partners. It has federal funding from the Workforce Investment Act. You will often hear referred to by its acronym as WIA, W-I-A, and the Wagner-Peiser Job Services Act, an act that goes back to the 1930s. And they also are the organized within the Workforce Service Agency are our self-sufficiency programs, the programs for vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, veterans employment services, the Centers for Independent Living, and some others. Their funding is very heavily federal funding, and this is the area in which we had to be very cautious about the match requirements and to some lesser extent maintenance of effort requirements. We are proposing reduction in their base rehab services budget of $442,000. We believe we can continue to meet our maintenance of effort. Just as an illustration, The proposed budget of $17,600,000 leverages $92.8 million of federal funds. And in programs that assist those who have barriers due to physical or mental handicaps in being productive, and it's a great program. So it was one we didn't take a significant cut, both because there is so much need, but also because of leveraging federal funds and maintain the maintenance of efforts. State services for the blind, similarly, that $139,000 a year will reduce a position and reduce some legal aid. It has real impact. But it is one where I was hesitant, our team was hesitant to reduce it any further because of the leverage of federal funds and also growing need to help both on vocational services, people with visual disabilities, blind, or limited sight who want to work, and an increasing number of elderly blind who need independent living services. This appropriation of $11,972,000 leverages about almost $21.5 million of federal funds, and so the maintenance of effort there was also important. Extended employment is a state program. Some portion of it helps us match some federal funds, but it is a state-funded program to assist those with barriers to work, and it's a program that we work in partnership with community rehabilitation providers and is a statewide program. This cut is not insignificant, but it is a relatively small percentage of their budget. We're reasonably confident we can continue to provide services. That one is not a match issue. Independent living services does have a federal match. We match with the $4,760,000 of state money, we match $4.83 million of federal money. We believe that we will not jeopardize any of our federal match with this recommendation. Supported employment for the mentally ill is a program that has remarkable results. When we can help people who have chronic and persistent mental illness get back to work, they can often do so at very good wage levels. They have excellent persistence. It is a program that we were hesitant to take a large reduction in. This reduction is not insignificant, but it's a program with great results. We now move into some pass-through grants to private nonprofits that do great work. I would have loved to have had more money for each of them. I know many of them will advocate for more money, and I wish we had. Twin Cities Rise, I think you're familiar with. It is a outcome-based job training program that works in many cases with very hard-to-serve populations, some of them with a criminal background, some of them with very limited work experience. They get great results. They have some capacity to raise funds, but this reduction we know has an impact on their program. Northern Connections is something of a new idea. It is based in Perham, Minnesota. It is telephone assistance for those who have recently come off Minnesota Family Investment Program, and it's they can describe it better than I can, but it's essentially coaching for those on MSIF to help them stay employed and help them deal with obstacles to employment. It's a very efficient program. I have been up to visit them in Perham and am impressed. It was funded for two biennia. We'd like to continue the funding, but unfortunately at a somewhat lower level. Extended Employment Center for the Deaf fits into our mission as helping maintain self-sufficiency. There are deaf programs at the Department of Human Services also, but the legislature funded this program through our agency the last couple of biennia. We work very closely with them. We're proposing a very small change. Advocating change together. Some of you know Rick Cardenas, who is a passionate advocate for this program. We're not recommending any change here. They assist handicapped people and their families in advocating for themselves, in advocating change together, and in making those with barriers to employment more effective advocates. LifeTrack is a little more complicated in that we're proposing a cut to their general fund dollars, but not their workforce development dollars, so it is not as, again, a program based here in St. Paul that we think does great work, but we had a target, unfortunately, that we needed to make. Youth Build, we are reducing their general fund, but not reducing a much larger appropriation in the workforce development fund. The workforce, that's the general fund, although there's one I missed. A big one. Job Skills Partnership, I don't want to pick between programs because they're all great programs, but this is the cut that maybe pains me more than any other. But we had to do it. We couldn't meet our targets without reducing this program, and it doesn't have a federal match. It does have some carryover capacity, but it's an incredibly important program. And if the Congress were to suddenly authorize us to print our own money or run deficits or to send us some unstructured money, this is probably one of the cuts I'd like to put back first. And we can talk more about Job Skills Partnership if you have questions. It's a great program, but one, in order to meet our targets, that we had to take a larger cut than I'm comfortable with. From the Workforce Development Fund. The Workforce Development Fund is...
Commissioner McElroy, I'm going to stop you right there and open it up for questions for the first two, and that way, if we have some time left, we'll get into the Workforce Development Fund. My concern is that we have some people had some questions, and we'll try to save a half an hour for the Workforce Fund, and if we need to come back, we'll come back.
Mr. Chairman, we're available to come back whenever we need it.
Thank you. I think Representative Norton had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for my voice.
Lovely voice.
That's right. I'm wondering if you could walk me through a little bit about how you evaluated the programs that you currently have in existence in order to make the determination for these particular cuts to this point. And I guess I'm also wondering on the programs that I see, how you also weighed the impact urban versus rural, because I assume on some of these programs, seems like there's a large number of them that I see right away that are Twin Cities related. If you could just tell me, what was your measurement? How did you decide which one of these programs is saving the state money? How much money? Was that part of your factor in deciding which ones to keep and which ones not? And if you have those measurements about how successful these individual programs are, I'd love to see some of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, let me take those one at a time. How do we evaluate programs? And then the rural-urban, which may be more complicated. We may have to do a little analysis for that. But some of our programs have metrics that are in federal statute or in state law, others that we have established. And we, on the website Accountability Minnesota, maintain metrics for most of our programs. They aren't all at the individual kind of line item level. Some of them, for example, in economic development, may combine the effects of JobZ, the Minnesota Investment Fund, and the Small Cities Economic Development Fund. And in that one, we measure things like jobs created at a wage above our target, which for most of our programs is $10.80 an hour, some including benefits and some not, and the amount of property tax or capital investment that was present in those programs. Typical criteria on economic development are jobs, wage level, benefits, investment. On the workforce development side, we often have more measures because the Federal Workforce Investment Act has a long series of accountability measurements, but focusing on placement, wage level, and retention, and to some extent, career path potential in some of the programs. And I relied on the staff that, and our management team relies on the staff that works with and monitors, for example, pass-through grantees. Bonnie Elsie is here, who is the director of our Workforce Development Division, and Bonnie can come up. But she has a team of people that get monthly or quarterly, or in some cases maybe annual, but quarterly generally, reports from the Workforce Service Area agencies, for example, or from pass-through vendors like Northern Connections or Twin Cities Rise, probably Women Venture also. And we measure them against their metrics and then took the recommendation from the program staff that worked with them. We didn't have any that aren't meeting basic metrics. Some of them we don't find kind of in their aligned with our core mission. But the four that we are recommending not funding, the Inventors Congress, good program. We think it duplicates what we do through the Small Business Development Centers and U.S. Small Business Administration, but it's not an indication that they've, and they have a hard time measuring did they create jobs or tax base, but they certainly work toward it. And it has become more of a year-round program and less of an event in recent years, and we're fully aware of that. And we expect that the committee or Representative Rocavina's committee will have an opportunity to hear from. Boys Clubs and Girls Clubs, great program. Probably not, and in the long term, it has an effect on employment, that they're doing some work-related work with younger children. We're not critical of the program. Didn't rise to the level of priority as things like the Dislocated Workers Program or Job Skills Partnership. The Center for Rural Policy, I funded it when I was chair of this committee. I've been an advocate for it. But it is a fairly general academic community research organization, and it's hard to argue that its mission is either creating jobs or developing the workforce. Let's see, there was a fourth one that we defunded that we didn't fund. I'm blanking. Somebody will remind me. So we do our best to have measurements. They are often program measurements. When they got to the budget decision level, it was sometimes our people somewhat subjectively saying, related to mission, not outstanding performer, very good performer, good. Performance was less an issue than relation to the mission. Now, in terms of urban and rural, the big programs are state aid programs, extended employment, vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, often delivered through our 47 workforce centers. The economic development programs are statewide. We can have a discussion as to whether our pass-through grant recommendations fall more greatly on urban or rural. I don't think so. To be honest, our discussion was more, are these expenditures core mission or not, rather than making a conscious effort to divide carefully between urban and rural. As I think about it, I think it's pretty close, but that wasn't the criteria. The criteria is core mission, outstanding performance.
Representative Popney, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the other one that you missed was the entrepreneurs and small business grants, as you were talking about. So I'm just going to follow up maybe on Representative Norton's side, because it does appear that some of the things that were really slotted to be zeroed out are rural economic development-related enterprises, either the Rural Policy and Development Center, the Inventors Congress, and the like. So I'm just, again, a bit concerned, since in the rural area, we really do need to grow jobs and keep people in our region so that you're not being inundated in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. But then I also wanted to just follow up on the entrepreneurs and small business grants, give you the opportunity to talk about that.
Mr. Chairman, that's a program that was, of which Representative Gunther has been a principal advocate. It started at the Riverbend Center for Entrepreneurship in Blue Earth. It serves three southern Minnesota counties, Blue Earth, Faribault, and Martin County. It, to some extent, duplicates services available through the Region 9 Small Business Development Center at Mankato. And the results in the Mankato Center are dramatically, and we can get you a results report on both programs. Our friends at Boys Clubs and Girls Clubs probably wouldn't agree that's a more urban program and was a larger appropriation. We do have 9 small business development centers, 8 of which are in Greater Minnesota and 1 of which is in the metro area. And they have 36 outreach locations. I believe 33 or 32 of them are in Greater Minnesota. So we do, many of our programs focus more in Greater Minnesota, in both economic, principally in economic development, because cities and counties in areas that are less dense don't have the same capacity that the city of Minneapolis has or the city of St. Paul has. We do try and achieve that balance, but I understand your concern. And we're not being critical of the Riverbend program, but simply that it appears to us to duplicate fairly significantly the Small Business Development Center program, where we can leverage federal funds and partnership funds.
Yes. Just one follow-up. For some of these areas, just take the Minnesota Inventors Congress, for instance. Is that one that could possibly be rolled into something? I mean, if it's worthy and has been worthy for a number of years of being an event and being something, and maybe it's being duplicated or replicated, but if it could continue to exist, I'm just curious about that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pompey, there have been suggestions in the past that they apply for the grant program from Explore Minnesota Tourism, or that they ask Redwood County to use some of the money from, if, and I don't recall if they have a lodging tax, but it's the kind of thing lodging taxes have been used for. I also don't recall if Redwood County levies either its economic development or other local ED levies, but there are some other possibilities. It also is an appropriation that hasn't had a match requirement in the past. So to some extent, they haven't had to develop a fundraising capacity other than, I believe they have admission charges. They do sell a program with some advertising. I don't know if they have an entry fee or not, but certainly there are some other ideas that we could help them explore.
Representative Winkler, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm hoping for a little bit of context, I guess, to the budget recommendations. You mentioned that you essentially got a target, I think, from the governor's office and MMB, in which you had to fit these programs, and it seemed, I have no reason to question that you did a great job of taking your target and trying to go through all the various programs. And I, in particularly, I think it's a good sign that you're willing to put some money towards the BioBusiness Alliance, and also in your proposals that you're going to be focusing in part on early stage companies and trying to get that pipeline going again. But I guess the larger question is, who creates the economic policy, or who looks at the economic situation that we're in and tries to formulate the budget in order to address those specific needs? Because if you're just getting it, and you know, the corporate income tax cut, it didn't come to your agency as a idea. Apparently, it came from MMD and the governor's office. And yet, if they hadn't done that, there'd be a lot more money in your budget to deal with maybe some of the specific issues that we're dealing with in Minnesota. So who looks at the state of the economy and tries to come up with an overall policy that might help us get out of the present situation, if it's not you? And I guess that goes to the MMD. Who's doing the analysis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler. Let me start with the proposal to reduce the business tax. The idea came from the 21st Century Tax Commission, whose report has been discussed with the governor and went into that recommendation. The report, I'm told, is about to be released. The strategy was crafted at the Department of Revenue, working with the governor's office, and we were certainly consulted in that. The answer to your question is the buck stops with the governor, but he consults a variety of commissioners and advisors on, you know, what is the role of the state in helping bring our economy out of recession. And so my team had a role in that, as did the Department of Revenue. We have a group that we bring together called the Jobs Trends Working Group that has been asking the question, why have we been losing jobs since 2006? That involves the state economist, the state demographer, the research director at the Department of Revenue, and the economists from our office, Bob Isaacson and Steve Hine. And so we work together across state agencies to address the economic policy. The target was set, and agencies have different targets. Some agencies have larger targets than others. We had a target of approximately 10% of our general fund and workforce development appropriations, although we got some relief on that with some of our proposals, some of our initiatives. Some agencies had higher targets than that. We believe that our work was a high priority because of the state of the economy.
Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up?
I think this is the working group that you referred to. This they have a PowerPoint out from 2008 that Mr. Isaacson sent to me.
That's the job trends.
Sorry. Job trends, yeah. And three things that kind of pop out, and we've discussed this already. The hypothesis is that construction jobs, the decline of the airline, relative decline of Northwest Airlines, and a small pipeline in startup and new businesses is three big factors that are hindering job growth. And,
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, but it oversimplifies the issue on housing. The decline of the housing market had a multifaceted impact on Minnesota's economy. It was
mortgage insurance on it.
And the biggest one was building materials manufacturing. In wood products manufacturing, kitchen cabinets, a variety of things, We think our Bob Isaacson's team, who runs labor market information, believes that we've lost about 26,000 jobs directly related to that cluster. The changes in the airline industry are principally Northwest, but also Champion Airlines went out of business and closed. I don't remember exactly how many of the jobs that was, but it was moderately significant. Mesabi was sold to Northwest and has less of a presence here. Sun Country has changed and has somewhat fewer employees. So the airline industry is certainly an impact. And then the national financial market has made it much more difficult to raise venture capital or to do an individual or initial public offerings. And so the pipeline of new company jobs is challenged.
Mr. Chair, but in all that story, which I think is the most important story that we have to deal with in Minnesota, is our relative decline compared to the nation. We can't do anything about the national economy or the international economy, but we have to be really worried about our comparative decline. And that whole, and as a policymaker, I think that should really be our priority in terms of economic development and looking at our economy, is our comparative standing with the rest of the country. And nothing in this analysis points to a need to reduce the corporate income tax as a way of addressing these particular challenges. We're talking about more industry-specific and in parts of the economy that are specific. There's nothing in here that says large corporations are leaving the state because the corporate income tax is too high. And I still don't have an understanding of where the economic analysis comes from that says that we should be putting hundreds of millions of dollars towards cutting this corporate tax. I asked the Commissioner of Finance at a overview hearing on the governor's budget last week, where is the economic analysis that supports this? And his answer was, it's a philosophy. Are you aware of a concrete economic analysis that supports that? Because we could be using that money for lots of other good things that you're doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, this is a very appropriate and a great discussion. I may not be the right one to have it with because I was not a member of the Tax Study Commission. Mike Beckett has chaired that effort. I have seen a draft of their report, but I probably haven't gone through it in the detail that I will later today and tomorrow. I would suggest if the kind of judgment of the House that this would be an appropriate place to have that discussion, I know Mike Beckett would come and have it with you. The Tax Study Commission did a fairly extensive analysis of the impact to which our total corporate tax climate has an impact on Minnesota. And it's not the critical factor in the decline of housing or wood product manufacturing or furniture manufacturing. I can tell you at least anecdotally it plays a role in our having not gotten Gamesa, the Spanish wind turbine company, to come to Minnesota. They went to Iowa. Taxes were a big deal. General Electric didn't build their wind turbine blade plant here in Worthington. They built it in Aberdeen, South Dakota. Taxes were a big deal. A million square foot plant. Acciones, another Spanish wind turbine manufacturer, went to Newton, Iowa, in part because there was an empty building and in part because the governor of Iowa gets the money through their insurance gross premiums tax, but in part because of our tax climate. We do lose some deals because of our tax climate. I always emphasize that the business climate is multifaceted, and there are a lot of good things in my sales toolkit. Taxes is something of a challenge, but I would invite you to have Mike Beckett or Commissioner Ward Ines come back and talk about the economic analysis. My team hasn't been involved in that.
Mr. Chair, the only follow-up comment I would have then is if the Department of Employment and Economic Development is not directly involved in the formation of this policy, it concerns me because you're the ones who are looking at these issues day to day. And if we're relying on instead a commission who doesn't really report to anybody but the governor and the commissioner of finance can't really articulate a strong answer for why we're doing this, it seems to me that the case has not been made to prioritize hundreds of millions of dollars in this way.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. I have a couple of comments, but before I do, I wanted to welcome the pages have decided to come and listen to us and see if they can learn anything from us. So we have to be on our best behavior here. Welcome to the committee. Week three pages. Commissioner McElroy, and I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair to throw this one out, having sat through the state of manufacturing last night, it was pretty obvious that if you were a relatively large, a larger company, over 50 employees, taxes really were not, the corporate tax didn't bother. They went way down. Under 50 was a bit higher. There were certainly three or four other things ahead of that. So the idea of a philosophy, you might, particularly as the governor sent his addresses to that group talking about tax reduction versus employee training, schooling, state help, and a variety of other things. And I will, as my turn comes up, I will ask you about the Job Skill Partnership. You know, either the governor's not talking to you, or he's not listening. But I certainly have some. I'm flabbergasted that it's a philosophy rather than based in science. With that, Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first wanted to ask about the cut to the Boys and Girls Clubs. You touched on it briefly, Commissioner McElroy. But if you could give me a little more help with that, that has been a remarkable program, certainly in our area of the state and in others, in bringing along youth, particularly youth at risk. And I can think of a number of examples. Representative Hawes, I think, is familiar with them as well, of people who have succeeded in becoming tremendous assets to our work environment in Minnesota. And I was a little surprised to see it zeroed out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gutwell, you know, in a perfect world that might not have happened, but it is important for early stage development of work habits. We did not reduce our appropriation, our recommendation for $7 million for Minnesota summer youth. We got about $10 million of Workforce Investment Act money for youth programs. We work with a variety of other partners. There's additional summer youth money that goes, for example, to Minneapolis and St. Paul. Boys Club and Girls Club is not a bad program. We thought it was an unusual use of the Workforce Development Fund. The Workforce Development Fund should be more specifically geared to programs like the Dislocated Workers Program or Extended Employment and be more specific. But we understand that it is a fine program. We expect them to advocate their case. I told them personally that we would be more likely to be supportive if it could come from the general fund, although I don't have general fund dollars for them. The governor has also volunteered on at least a half a dozen occasions to speak at fundraisers to assist them with private fundraising activities. The majority of their money does come from private contributions. But it was an issue of having run out of resources before we ran out of needs.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yeah, follow up.
A follow-up more to Representative Winkler's comments. I think there's probably a valid question to be asked about who sets economic policy for the state of Minnesota, and I know that's going to be a line of questioning as we go forward. But the truth of the matter is when it comes to budgetary matters, it ends up being a combination of the governor's office and us, the state legislature. So I would argue that if we've got different things we want to see on this sheet or other things in the budget for economic policy, then it's really up to us, the state legislators, to reflect that. I would also say, I know there's been some question about whether or not taxes and regulatory climate do impact job creation or job losses in the state and whether it contributes to our below national average performance lately. I have 2 points of reference. One of them is I've spent a number of years visiting manufacturers and employers in our area of the state and asking them specifically, what are your challenges? And in almost every single instance, tax and regulatory climate come up. They may not be number one, but they're certainly number two or number three. The Minnesota Business Partnership, some of you may have received this issue brief from them just recently. I think I received this last week from them. But it mentions again that at 41.4%, Minnesota's combined state and federal corporate income tax rate is third highest in the industrialized world. This is what Governor Plenty has been referring to. And these sorts of burdens do make a difference, not only in job creation here, but expansions of businesses in the state of Minnesota going elsewhere, and us not being able to attract new business investment in the state of Minnesota. There is no doubt that that is a leading factor. And I would hope that's the reason that the governor's office proposed the cut in corporate income tax. It is clearly a factor, and certainly a competitive one when you look at neighboring states.
Representative Hollis?
Thank you very much. Mr. Gottwald, Representative Gottwald, I truly agree with you on the Boys and Girls Club. You know, and many on this list you were very positive about. And I can do both. I can do anecdotes and tell you stories that make you feel real bad about that cut. And many of these organizations can take their mission out and their guideline and their statistics and prove to you the individual benefits, and then you can extend that into the damage and the unintended consequence. You mess with this independent lifestyle and mental illness supported employment, and you take the cut, you get the benefit, and you know who you've hurt, but then you're going to have to go in and repair the damage after that. And those are measurable, and those are recordable. I would say just one story in a Boys and Girls Club. I've watched them go into a couple areas, and after they were there a year, the crime rate went down in those areas measurably by 40%. You reduce it, and I suspect it's going to go up again, and that's an unintended consequence. Now, on this, when we're looking at where we're going to make, where who's going to win and who's going to lose, who's going to get benefits, when we do the tax reduction, I would really like to hug the philosophy that you're giving me. But I would like to have something a little bit more secure in my mind that when we make this investment, we're going to have an expected goal. And that goal is going to be measurable because I know the damage it's doing, because some of these other things we're reducing to make that investment. And can't, if we're making that investment, can't we hold it to the same type standard as we held the mental illness support employment group to? They said, we want you to measure these things. We want to know what it is that you're going to accomplish. How do we measure it? And how do we get rid of it if it's not working? We're getting rid of some things that are working, and I'm not too sure that the other is going to work. Are you pretty confident that's going to work, that jobs are going to be created, businesses are going to fluctuate? How do I get some security? How do you measure it? How do you get it stopped if it's not working? Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hopp, if the question is, am I absolutely sure that raising the corporate, reducing the corporate tax burden will bring jobs to Minnesota? I have to ask, over what period of time? Over 5 years, I'm absolutely sure that we will be more competitive. And as we compete for wind turbine manufacturing facilities or biorefineries or solar panel manufacturers, that in the long term, that it makes our competitive arsenal stronger. I can't tell you how quickly those results come, because big projects are hard. Well, we like projects of all sizes, but projects are caught up in the financial liquidity confidence tightness at the moment. But I'm told that the report of the tax task force has some data in comparison to other states. I have not, very honestly, had time to look at it yet. I will. It is a reasonable public policy question. When we had to make decisions about both our own agency management managed programs and our partnership programs, in some cases we had very concrete results to look at. In some cases it was a more subjective connection to the mission. The governor, in having discussions with me, with business leaders, with a variety of others, has been convinced by the fact that tax climate is a problem. It is ultimately something that this legislature gets to make decisions on. In the long term, I'm confident it brings jobs. In the it will take some time for that to happen.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
In order to get it to work on a short-term basis, if you know it's going to take 5 years, do you think that if you refocused it and have it a little bit more targeted, that you could get some benefit next year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, I may not be the best one to ask that question. Commissioner Innes at Revenue and his research department have done more work in this area. If by focus you mean job creation tax credits or some other narrower program, my concern is that the relocation consultants that kind of dominate the decision making look both at short-term incentives and long-term tax funding. We have had some short-term incentives with JobZ and the Minnesota Investment Fund, and we score quite well. It's how we were successful with Moventis, for example, building a wind turbine facility, gearbox facility in Faribault. In the long term, our tax climate has been, you know, scores against us. We try to overcome that with the quality of our workforce or connections to higher education or connections to transportation. But the long-term climate is also very important. It's hard to be third in the world or first in the nation and score very well. And increasingly, big location decisions are made by IBM consulting or location consultants or Deloitte or Pricewaterhouse or others, consulting with even fairly medium-sized companies, engage location consultants today to help them evaluate the respective costs of doing business in various locations.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative.
When we drop down into the specialized tax credits, and I've argued on both sides of these issues, I kind of, you know, I plant my feet firmly on both sides of the issue. But as you go to some of these, like JobZ's, I mean, the auditor was very, you know, very negative about JobZ's, and some of the people interviewed were saying, well, we would have done it, not some, but like 25%, so we would have made this investment anyway. How can you get that cut off in those programs so that you're not just giving a tax break to somebody that would be using it? It kind of turns into welfare for the rich, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, you mentioned the legislative auditor's report on JobZ. Since that report came out last year, we've made a great many changes, some of them legislatively in the last session, some of them administratively, to add more rigor to the process. And the biggest change was that our agency now has to approve new job opportunity building zone applications, and they have to have a positive return on investment. We didn't have that in the original law. We also now get to consider whether a JobZ applicant has competitors in the local market. We didn't have that originally. And although the there were some projects where the legislative auditor interviewed owners that said we would have done it anyway, there's some very big projects that clearly could not have been done. One of them, the Arctic Cat engine factory, they were ready to go to Wisconsin. Polaris with their test facility, or Anderson Windows with the renewal facility, Suzlon in Pipestone, or Daktronics in Redwood Falls, we're absolutely sure those couldn't have happened. The people from Moventis, a Finnish company going to Faribault, have told us, but for JobZ, we'd be in Iowa. And so some of it is, we think we made some real improvements in JobZ. The debate as to whether we should have more targeted tax credits versus an overall reduction in the tax rate, public policy debate, I look forward to participating.
Mr. Commissioner, it would be really nice for me to understand with the JobZ's, how many waivers and renegotiated downward or upward some of the goals that they were, those companies were required to meet, and how many they got to. And if you could share that with the committee, that'd be great. I don't need it right now. I would suspect you need to think through that one. My question really is the Job Skills Partnership. And I went to the State of Manufacturing last night, and you know, and I don't want to belabor tax cuts, and I won't, but it was difficult to listen to the speech by our governor claiming the need to be greener, leaner, help companies figure out their investment strategies for equipment and training, and then not explain how when we, and I, again, it's, you know, it's the policy committee, so I want to have the kind of the underlying idea as to how you get to this goal of helping these companies with what essentially is a 25% cut in this fund. Again, we're trying to make our companies more competitive, leaner, greener, train their employees on new equipment, but yet we're going to take this money away. Are we looking to, or is the intent of the agency to charge companies more for this particular service? Because I know that there is a state and employer partnership there in funding. How do we make up for that? Because these companies, all 400, 500, 600 people that were in attendance last night, the only more optimistic, well, I won't say that, but they were very optimistic business people. And if we're going to take something out from underneath them, how do we reprop that up?
Mr. Chairman, we will be looking for opportunities, whether it's funds from other programs or in the federal stimulus package. This will remain one of the largest programs of its type in the world, or in the country, excuse me. North Dakota, for example, has a program that they started 2 years ago, funded at $1 million a year. We're funded. We will continue to have moderately significant resources, but as I indicated, this is one of the hardest cuts that we made. Job training is a high priority. We are not intending to increase the match requirement. The match requirement is principally in use of equipment, location, supervisor time, employee time. It's principally soft dollars. Nor are we intending it to be harder on our training institutions. We will be able to do fewer grants. But we will also try to be creative. This committee, and we appreciated it, put a requirement in the curriculum has to be shared freely among grantees. We hope by doing that to be able to reuse curriculum in one part of the state that may have been created elsewhere and reduce the curriculum development cost. We hope to be as creative as possible in working with educational institutions and multiple employers. Often it is not dramatically more expensive to train 60 people than 40, and you can have multiple employers work together on some skills in areas like lean manufacturing or quality control or CNC programming. Probably more so in the manufacturing area than in healthcare or construction. So we will. I have a great staff, a great team that works in that area. We're going to try hard to be creative, but we share your concern. It would be nice to have more resources for that program. We operate at. We ran out of dollars before we ran out of priority.
Mr. Commissioner, you can. I'm sure you. You understand my frustration with kind of feeling like the left hand is not understanding what the right hand is doing or not working in concert. But you brought up another point, the shared curriculum. Does your department keep track of that sharing, or would that be minuscule? Because it would be nice to know for us, if Dunwoody is sharing with St. Paul Tech College or Cambry is sharing with Itasca.
Mr. Chairman, let me talk about what we know happens now and then what's required under the legislation passed last year.
No. I would prefer to understand who would I ask to track that so that we can check that out ourselves.
The majority of the sharing that's done today is done through Minsky. They've created an entity called the Learning Objects Library. It's run by Pat Opak, whose brother many of us served with, Joe, who's now the chair or the president at Normandale. It isn't perfect by any means, but it's quite advanced. Our grant criteria now require, and have since the legislation passed last year, that there be more sharing across institutional systems, but the vast majority of JobScout partnership grants go to Minsky institutions. And I don't have the percentage off the top of my head, but it's significant.
We'll look into that, and I'll share that with the committee. President Breinhardt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did I really mess it up again?
No, you're getting it.
I've been practicing.
Make a motion to adjourn.
I'm there in the pronunciation of my name. So, Commissioner McElroy, I'd like to have further comments on the total, the zeroing out of the funding for the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And I'd like to make a few comments on your comments on why that was eliminated. You said that the role, that it wasn't the same role, and that it was a research institute. And having been around when it first came to the legislature for funding, I think you'll recognize that the center perceives itself a little bit differently, in the sense that just research. We have a whole range of academic institutions across the state that do research, and that we can avail ourselves of for simple research purposes. But the center initially positioned itself to provide targeted and timely research on policy issues that directly related to job development, quality of life in outstate Minnesota. Very hands-on issues that I think BEAD is directly responsible for. So I think it relates very directly to the goals, you know, of your agency. And I'd just like you to comment on that in terms of that cut.
Mr. Chairman, and let me see if I can do this right. Reinhart?
Yeah.
All right. I read the Rural Policy Journal carefully. I value what I learn from it. But when I ask the question, do we have more jobs or do we have higher paying jobs or more economic development but for the work done in the center, we had trouble making it as high a priority as some of our other programs. It's not to say it isn't valuable. But with limited resources, as I indicated, we ran out of dollars before we ran out of priorities. Jack Geller was somebody I admire greatly, and I continue to work with him at Crookston. I have not been as probably communicated with his leadership as much in recent months as I did earlier. But we understand, I think your clarification of the mission is helpful, that it is specific and targeted. It clearly goes well beyond job creation. I recall a recent issue on the role of women in greater Minnesota, and the issue before that on health care in greater Minnesota, an issue before that on the challenges of the operating school systems in greater Minnesota. So yes, they do touch on things that are very important to us, but it would be hard to argue that it's directly aligned with our core mission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right on with a follow-up.
Commissioner, what I'd ask of you is to give the center a chance to answer exactly those questions you raised, because I believe they can. I believe all the issues that you mentioned in terms of the journal publication do relate to economic development issues in rural Minnesota, and they would make a case for their application and targeted use, timely and targeted information.
Representative Winkler, did you have a question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a follow-up on your point before about who to ask. You know, the total budget, whether it's the governor's or the legislature's, is a document that should guide, in large part, economic policies of the state. There are very few priorities that would rise above the economic health of Minnesota in our long-term, in the long term. And so I guess it's important to come back to this. You say you're not the right person to ask about the corporate income tax and that there are a variety of people. Is there a point person? Is there somebody that we could come in and have talk to us about the economic consequences of the total budget that we're considering? Or is there no single point of responsibility other than the governor, who I'm not going to suggest come to testify? Is there somebody else that we can talk to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, let me ask that in two ways. Is there or should there be? We don't have a Council of Economic Advisors in the same context the federal government does. And tax policy is set after taking advice from various commissions and citizens and others by the Commissioner of Revenue. But let me have a conversation with Commissioner Hansen, for example, and direct your question to him. Ultimately, the governor is responsible. When it comes to the budget, Commissioner Hansen usually speaks on his behalf. But with this tax issue, perhaps he and Commissioner Innes and myself need to confer further. I like the question, but I don't know that it's surprising that I recall in 2001, we had difficulty getting to a budget conclusion, and Senator then Governor Ventura went on television saying it's just like the legislature didn't get their term paper done.
Well, people don't understand that the budget is a collection of 10 or 11 or 12, depending on the year, massive bills, and that the budget is not simple, and that it is very complicated. And how we could ask the same question, I think, about a variety of other subjects that have impact across agencies. Something we talk about is prosperity systems. And clearly in the discussion I just had with Representative Briner, the health of women is a prosperity, or the role of women in Greater Minnesota is a prosperity issue. K-12 education is a prosperity issue. I don't know that we're to a point where we've tried to weave those together in a singular prosperity strategy that's reflected in the budget. I wish I could say we have. In terms that you're concentrating on is cutting corporate taxes the best use of resources and the best kind of policy in this environment. I'm not the right one to answer that, but I will try to work with Commissioner Hansen and Commissioner Innes to get you an answer.
And thank you. I won't say anything more for the rest of the hearing, I promise. But I think it is dangerous to make generalized statements about the need to reduce the tax and regulatory burden on businesses in Minnesota without considering the consequences of that and without making specific mention of where we might stop. Because Minnesota's path to success has not been historically and will not probably be in the future as a low tax, low cost, laissez-faire kind of state. And so to advocate that one set of steps that we should take towards reducing the tax burden is good has to be taken in the context of how far are we supposed to go? What's the magic number? Where are we trying to get to with our tax and regulatory environment? I don't think it's enough just to say, well, this is a step in the right direction. We have to know how many steps in that direction we should actually be taking in looking at the long-term health of a variety of systems, which I think what you called the prosperity strategy. It seems to me that the state budget ought to be the prosperity strategy for the state one way or another. And if we're not considering the trends and the directions that we're heading in, I think comments about reducing the tax burden and looking at one company versus another company and what they decide to do is a dangerous and misleading discussion to have.
And I suspect I'll get a conversation with the tax chair before this committee, shortly after this committee is done. Representative Norton, I think you had a question?
I did indeed. We all seem to have our hot button issues, and I'm going to go back to one that I mentioned earlier, and that's training. One of the things I hear in my community a lot is government has too many programs. Now, mind you, I've advocated for some of these programs, so I'm taking a step back from that. And the question I'm wanting to know is, given the number of programs we have in this particular area of the budget, given the fact that there are cuts that seem to be wheedling away at some of these programs, and I would worry about the effectiveness of a program given some of these cuts, are they able to do the kind of job they did or a better job given less money? We're forever fighting with that in all of our budgets. Do we have too many? What would we lose if we took a different philosophy rather than just trimming on programs that we currently have, having kind of a major overhaul and just doing things completely different? And again, as I said, I've advocated for some of these, and I'll probably have people panicking with this suggestion. But I guess I'm worried. We do have a lot of little programs. Is there a better way to use the money we have to improve the workforce training and development in this state?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, it's interesting. This is not a new question. In fact, Representative Gunther commissioned a report, calls it lovingly the Gunther Report, that tried to identify all the job training programs that we have. And when it comes to job training, state government has a relatively small number of programs. It is when we get to working with partners like workforce service areas that may have their programs, or with very capable not-for-profit organizations like LifeTrack or Hired or others that we get the proliferation. When you look to us, we principally have the Workforce Investment Act, the dislocated worker programs, and then some programs for those with barriers like WFREA. The proliferation comes when there are pass-through grants, and when we then get to the further complexity of school districts or Rochester and Community and Technical College or others crafting programs that may combine resources from various places. sometimes I applaud the creativity of leveraging various resources. Sometimes I worry about a duplication of overhead and the number of executive directors or HR folks that we have. But to some extent, it depends on the ability of not-for-profits also are raising private dollars, whether it's United Way or other donors. And as they get results and make their case and they make their private match, maybe this is somewhat Darwinian. The job training programs provide that get results. And we don't see many jobs. I can't think of a job training program that continues to exist that doesn't have fairly measurable results. But I understand your concern. We're direct agency programs aren't terribly proliferated. It tends to be the wide variety of partners that we have.
Mr. Chair, if I could continue.
Representative Norton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, part of what you get to is the overhead costs of many of these different organizations, and I think I'm all for public-private partnerships. I've supported that in my own community and think that that's a wonderful way to leverage money. But I do have to, when I look at the list, even though they are flow-through grants, I wonder how well these different areas are going to be able to continue on with the cuts that we're giving them, and if there isn't a more effective way to use them. And I'm just throwing that out there. I do want to ask one more question, and that is with regard to the office, and it has to do specifically with bioscience, and that is with the Office of Entrepreneurship, which I've had an interest in, just the area of entrepreneurship with regard to biosciences, and also the Office of Science and Technology. Looks like there were cuts to those programs, one, maybe more. And then if you could tell me, what has the success of those been? Just briefly, and what we might expect in the future.
There's some, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, some confusion in names. On the exhibit I passed out, the program we call Small Business Innovative Research is also called the Office of Science and Technology. It is a state employee who assists Minnesota inventors, entrepreneurs, and small companies apply for federal research grants. Betsy Lusk can advocate, can provide lots of data. My recollection is that in 2007, Minnesota companies got about $35 million in federal grants from a wide variety of federal funders, including the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, the Office of Naval Research, and a variety of others. We think there is a lot of return on investment. There has been $200,000 of biennium in the base for that program. We did not cut that. Representative Mahoney and others succeeded in getting $400,000 in one-time money in the 2007 budget that is good until expended. It won't expire on. I would have loved to have gotten that money back in the governor's budget, and we ran out of, again, dollars before we ran out of priorities. I am a big supporter of that program. I'm hopeful that there may be opportunities, whether it's in the federal stimulus package or other ways, to continue to fund that. But it will... We support them, support that program, and support that wonderful staff member. Second issue is a pass-through grant to an organization called, it's the Riverbend Facilitation, and it's called Entrepreneurial Services. We believe it's fairly duplicative of the work provided by the Small Business Development Centers, and particularly the center in Mankato. I know that Representative Gunther and others are big fans of Riverbend, and I visited the Martin County kind of spinoff of that. I have not been to Faribault County of late, but they're working in those three counties. I certainly wouldn't argue it's a bad program, but we think it duplicates work done in our SBIRs.
Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a comment and then potentially a question. And my comment is in relationship to the discussion we've had, Mr. Chair, and specifically Representative Winkler, about proof of the corporate tax rate and what effect that has on the economy. We're looking for economic policy and proof, and I think those are fair questions, and I would encourage all of us to do our own research on that, as that is our job as legislators. But just anecdotally, I don't know if the others have been contacted like I have from many businesses telling me about their tax rate and what it's done to them. And if not, I would encourage all members to contact the Minnesota Business Partnership, which does include many, many businesses throughout the state of Minnesota, because it is a fact that at 41.4%, Minnesota's tax rate is the third highest in the industrialized world. And I think it's very naive to think that that doesn't have any impact. It's also a fact that 10 states with the most job growth between 2003 and 2008 had corporate income tax rates lower than Minnesota's. and that's from the Tax Foundation, U.S. Census Bureau, and U.S. Bureau of Statistics. And so I guess my overall comment is that, you know, we've had a couple weeks now to beat up on the governor and to beat up on the commissioners about what they're cutting, what they've decided to cut. And so my question to you, Mr. Chair, or perhaps Representative Winkler, is when is your caucus going to put forward their budget so that we can analyze it and we can actually get to work as a legislature to solve this thing? Because in every committee I've been in, all I've heard about is, you know, governor's wrong and the corporate tax cuts. Commissioners are wrong in their decisions, and I think that's a fair discussion. I think it's fair to ask those questions, but I also think it's fair to give us a timeline for when we can expect the budget from the majority party and when we can put these up side by side and get busy as a state and fix this budget problem and not just complain about what the governor's had to do.
Representative Pepin, as my father used to tell me on a regular basis, you know, if you give an accountant enough time, you can make a dollar look like $1 million and $1 million look like a dollar. And I suspect those tax surveys, I've heard all sorts of all over the board. I don't want to get into the argument whether we're third or we're 30th or whatever. We all have our own opinion. I suspect our budget and the majority party will come out sometime after the forecast that is coming up. I think it's the first week of March or whatever, so that we're not using funny numbers. That's the answer. And if you've got a response?
I do have a response. Well, I think it's great you'll be coming out with the budget in March. I don't think there's any doubt that we're going to have probably at least a $5 billion budget deficit, and I think that's a pretty workable number to start with. It's not going to get much better. It might get a little worse. And so I think that's wasting a month of when we could be getting down to work. So I would encourage you to encourage your caucus to start before then. Because I know that, you know, everybody wants to spend another month talking about the governor's budget and what he's doing and all the terrible cuts he's making. But I would like to know what your proposal is. If we're not going to cut spending, then presumably we're going to have to come up with other revenue, raising taxes. And I would like to know what that tax increase might be, what taxes you're looking at, and what that's going to mean for every Minnesota family so that I can have time to make my decisions on what I think would be how I'd want to vote and where I think we should go in the future.
Representative Pepin and I will pass those along to the appropriate Finance Committee chairs. I suspect there's a couple on this point. You have approximately 5 minutes before we're going to end this. I'm a building trades guy. We're ending on time. Representative Winkler, I think you had your hand up first.
Just to point out, Mr. Chair, that our mission as a committee is not to beat up on a commissioner. Our mission as a committee is to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of proposals sent to us by the governor at this point. And that is the role that the Commissioner McElroy has to play, is to defend those policies and priorities that the administration has set. And it's unfortunate if tough questions have to be asked, and he has to answer them when they're not his priorities, but I don't see any other members of the executive branch here to ask those questions up.
Representative Winkler, members of the committee, Commissioner McElroy, you know, from days past, I do know how to beat up on you, don't I? And I'm trying to professionally find some answers, and I hope I know your skin is thick enough, more than thick enough, to take whatever this committee has particularly handed out to you. Representative Beinart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is in response to Representative Pepin's comments on asking for the DFL budget. I think that's an inappropriate assignment in terms of what the legislative process is. The governor had 2 months to prepare his budget. He's put his budget out there. We have a couple months as a legislature to respond to that budget, and that is exactly what committee work and bill hearings are about, is bills are an opportunity to directly respond to line items on the budget, and we shape the budget through the omnibus bill process. So I think it's inappropriate to ask for a budget in advance of the legislative process itself, which will occur over the next couple months.
Representative Hilby, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
I did.
Go right ahead, and then we'll go to you, and we should have a couple minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, no, we'll go to Representative Hilty first, and then we'll right to you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is actually a question for Commissioner McElroy.
Oh, there we go.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I wanted to go back to the point about the number of programs and people's perception that there are an awful lot of those things and the question about overhead, et cetera. I'm sure we're all aware that these things just kind of, there's a kind of topsy principle here in which they just grow, you know, and accumulate. And what I'm wondering is, does the department have a vision of what we would like to see in an ideal economic development situation? That are all these programs compatible with your vision, if you have one?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, if I may limit my comments to job training, which is where the question was arose, we create a state unified plan under the Workforce Investment Act that sets priorities. And then entrepreneurs, nonprofits, local interests often create programs that meet a specific need in their community. And I don't think that's a bad thing. How we allocate a limited amount of federal funds and state funds in some cases is based on our priorities, but I take as an example LifeTrack Resources has partnered over the years with the Hmong American Partnership, the Cambodian Center, the Vietnamese Ethnic Community, the International Center, to tailor job training programs to particular languages or particular needs that it is helpful for them to do, but they have to compete often for grant programs or other funds that helps control the amount of overhead that they can have and continue to be competitive. I recall, think it is a bad thing to have an abundance of people with entrepreneurial spirit, often in nonprofits, that want to solve problems. It would probably be less expensive than having government programs or statewide agencies have to meet every one of those needs. But with that said, we try to be as strategic as we can, both when we set budgets, when we advise the governor, or when we make recommendations on things like pass-through grants. So we are strategic. So I don't know that I would want to set a limit. There can only be X job training programs in the state. But I do think it's appropriate to say that we should measure and report to you and ask them to report, how many placements did you have? What was the wage level? What was the retention for 6 months? Or perhaps we'd like to get longer than that, but 6 months seems to be, you know, what's trackable. It gets harder to track people further in advance than that. What percentage of the jobs you create have career ladders so that there are upward mobility career-wise? And if we have good information, then foundations can make decisions, this legislature can make decisions, our agency can make decisions. And so we accountability measures. And with good accountability measures, maybe a lot of programs isn't too many. Without accountability measures, a smaller number may still be too many. Let me just check with my staff and see if I fractured anything. Are we all right?
Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make it quick. And I, of course, want to respond to Representative Briner's and also Representative Winkler's comments. I'm not sure if you missed my point or not, but my point wasn't that we shouldn't be asking questions. We should be asking tough questions of the commissioners and the governor. I think that's fair, and I do think that's our job. But Representative Reinhart, when you say it's inappropriate to put a budget together and that we need 2 months, I would say it's inappropriate not to work on the budget. We've had the same 2 months. You had the same. You got the numbers the same time the governor did after the forecast. I heard the Speaker of the House after the budget came out saying that we need to look at zero-based budgeting, and I was very encouraged by that. Zero-based budgeting means you don't need to get recommendations from the agencies. We all have access to what the current budget is. We can all find out what we spent 2 years ago. We certainly have more information now. So there's absolutely no reason that we can't work on this right now. And saying that it's inappropriate to put a budget together before the governor's proposal comes out is just simply, I have to clarify that that is just simply not the case.
Well, I guess that's going to be the last word until I'm going to ask the committee if they're interested in coming back. Well, we covered most of the work, the last third, the Workforce Development Fund questions that we might have had. And if so, we'll contact you, your staff, Commissioner. So I thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, the committee is adjourned.